Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, damas y caballeros, welcome to The Warrior Poet. On today's episode, we're going to talk process, Canadians, and how the best plan has little to do with the plan at all. There was this time around Shakespeare, I think, where it was really popular to come up with weird nicknames for people that you liked, or maybe people you didn't like. Maybe people just liked each other a lot less, and so came up with ridiculous nicknames for people they hated. Of course, I don't actually know it was around Shakespeare. I think there's this American habit to just assume that everything before World War I in England or the British Empire was around Shakespeare's time, give or take a few hundred years, maybe 500 years. Anyway, regardless of when this happened, besides thanking our British brethren / forefathers and mothers for things like common use of the colors red, white, and blue, and warm beer, we can thank them for crazy nicknames like Hank for Henry, Maggie, and I think Peggy, and a whole bunch of other things like Hattie for the name Margaret, or Dick for Richard, and there's a name Bud, and I think that name is maybe for Robert, maybe it's for something else. Not totally sure, as a Naval Academy grad and someone who was on a ship for a little bit, you would think that I would have read the naval classic Billy Budd. I haven't. It's kind of like that Aziz Ansari quote in Parks and Rec. I think that Bud, though, is spelled with two D's at the end. It also falls prey to the problem of never trusting a fictional character with two first names. Anyway, the point here is not to rant about how people just can't have simple nicknames anymore, like Shree, but really because I was reminded of a book called Special Trust recently, which was authored a couple decades back, probably by a guy named Bud McFarlane. His real name's Robert or Bob McFarlane, and he was the national security advisor for Ronald Reagan, at least one of them, only for about 2 or 3 years, I think. He got caught up in the Iran-Contra affair. He was also a Marine who served in the Vietnam War and a Naval Academy alumnus. He, at one point in his life, right before he was getting ready to testify before Congress, was counting between 20 and 30. I think the Wikipedia article for his entry says between 25 and 30. And he was counting all the Valium pills that were left in the jar so that he could take all of them at once and end his life because, in his words, he had failed his country. Okay, so without passing judgment on whether Bud McFarlane's actions were good or not, he received a pardon, by the way, by George H.W. Bush, I think Christmas of 1992 or something like that. Not that necessarily makes him innocent. Plenty of very guilty parties receive pardons from presidents on a regular basis. But whether or not what he did was correct, I do respect the fact that he took his oath so seriously, that he was so despondent on the eve of his testimony to Congress about the Iran-Contra affair that he felt the need to end his life. He ended up surviving thankfully, I think just as another human, and also because he chose to do some good with that lease on life. I'm not sure whether his life has been 100% kosher, just in case it hasn't. I'm going to put that disclaimer out there. But the book Special Trust, which I read before I went to the Naval Academy, was particularly powerful to me in terms of what the obligations of someone serving on behalf of a people, in this case, the American people, how serious that oath is in business books all the time. There's the concept of the principal agent problem. And as we've established here on the Warrior Poet countless times, most people in the private sector are just out for themselves. And while the government is no beacon of efficiency or ethics necessarily, you do find in the military and perhaps in some areas of government, people who are out for a mission beyond themselves, out for societal impact way beyond themselves. That's not to say that those people don't ever exist in the commercial sector, and certainly they do exist probably in plenty amongst the nonprofit NGO area of the economy, but it's much rarer in anywhere else but the military, from what I have seen at least. But if you can't trust national security advisors, who can you trust? Can you trust yourself? Maybe, but maybe not. We've talked on previous episodes about all sorts of issues with trusting ourselves. And of course, there's the Robert Feynman quote on that, which pretty much every podcaster repeats. So I won't repeat that here. You can look it up for yourself. I had a fellow officer, a shipmate, if you will, which, by the way, the word shipmate is almost a curse in the Navy. It can be used in all sorts of manners. You can use it kind of like a four-letter word. It has that kind of spectacular versatility and power. You could call someone you hate a shipmate. And often the word shipmate is used by those who are enforcing rules that everybody hates. Anyway, there was a shipmate who is still in the Navy and called me up the other day asking about private sector opportunities and how he should think about those opportunities relative to his military career. At one point in the conversation, he mentioned the need to deprogram himself. And I thought that was very wise of him, even though he has been listening to the Warrior Poet. So maybe some of that I can credit myself for. But no, in all seriousness, I thought that was very self-aware. We all need to deprogram ourselves sometimes. But if we can't trust ourselves, this raises a serious question. When we make some sort of decision where there's no clear path in front of us, and where we set a process for ourselves, when do we know it's done? How do we know it's time to start executing without constantly readjusting the plan and losing faith? I find myself that it's much easier to make a decision, set a process, and execute it in an established organization. But when it's yourself, all of a sudden, you give yourself license to second guess all over the place. The main focus here in this episode is how we can know if something is half-baked or if it's fully baked. As the outside observer looking at other people, it's very easy to judge someone and conclude that their plan hasn't had enough time in the oven. But when it comes to ourselves, how can we get some closure and start executing on the things that are important to us? for those who have been listening to the podcast over the last couple months, it will come as no surprise that your humble host has been reading Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. It is a really long book, and it's caused a lot of ideas in my head. So thank you for the continued patience to loyal listeners who may not be fans of the book or not care about all the addiction-related topics they're in. However, those addiction-related topics do get you thinking a lot about what is going on inside your head. We talked about a character in Infinite Jest called Don Gately in episode number 38, Gately's Paradox. We also talked about in episode 34 called Worthless Chorus, we talked about how sometimes we can be too good for the wisdom that is all around us, the aphorisms that we hear on a regular basis, but just don't internalize until nature just hits us over the head and it finally sinks in. There's a short passage where Don Gately is talking to himself, and he's talking about a new resident named Jeffrey Day. And of course, talking of nicknames earlier, it says Jeffrey, parentheses, not Jeff, comma, Jeffrey Day has been at N House 6 days. And as this paragraph goes on in the first third of the book, Don Gately is thinking about his mentor. Don Gately is this recovering addict, but he's been clean enough and is big enough of a tough guy to enforce the rules in this place called Ennett House, that he's thinking about what his mentor has told him about new addicts who are coming to recovery. And according to Gene M, that's Gene with a G, apparently it's a guy. According to Gene M, it's the newcomers with some education that are the worst, according to Gene M. They identify their whole selves with their head, and the disease makes its command headquarters in their head. This gets at a problem of a lot of those who are well-educated and ambitious and focused. A lot of times they end up succumbing to analysis paralysis, making the whole question of how we know when our plans are fully baked even more important. You know this process? Canadians. Actually, that's not really true. I feel like Germans and the Dutch and the British probably love process a lot more, especially the British. I mean, they ruled my people for a very long time. I mean, my people being Indians, as in the nickname Shree, a very small number of Nazis about process dictated over a populace insanely larger in size. So, yeah, are the Canadians part of the British whatever is going on now? It's not really a colony at this point, but it's part of what is known as the Commonwealth of Nations. I don't know why 54 or so former colonies of the British Empire would want to just hang out and trade notes about how they're doing now, but I think that's pretty much what the Commonwealth of Nations amounts to now. No, Canadians, even though they stem very closely from the British, just as we do in America, but with far less average pigment, they do love saying the word process as process. And they also love saying the word project as project. Those are, to me, besides the word about, the easiest ways to tell if someone is Canadian or not. And I would guess probably the hardest things for them to drop if they end up moving to America and leaving their beloved Tim, not Timothy Hortons, behind. As my time on the ship was ending, I became the engineering special projects officer, or if you're Canadian, it would be the engineering special projects officer on the ship. I really, again, speaking of nicknames, really wanted to, instead of being the ESPO, be the ESPN. I really struggled to come up with a good word in this backronym I was creating for the N, unfortunately. I was never able to finally clinch that. But one of the things I did as the engineering special projects officer was work on, you guessed it, process. Now, I do really love the imagery that David Foster Wallace creates there. I dare say Bud McFarlane would appreciate it as well in terms of the disease, meaning alcoholism, taking up its command headquarters in the brain. There's a perception of military people in terms of process that they just follow orders, as opposed to being people who take initiative without analysis paralysis. In fact, military people probably have much less of a problem getting out of cement, not getting stuck, than those who have not been in the military. People who do take initiative, they just make a decision, lay out the steps, and do those steps. Now, contrast that with another company that I worked for, Amazon, where there's this interesting kind of barbell, if you will, with respect to process. You've got, on the one hand, an extreme lack of process, intentionally so, where decisions are made very quickly. There's not extreme amounts of hierarchy in order to move fast like a startup. But at the same time, Amazon is, in my opinion, a very command and control organization. I'm not necessarily saying that's a bad thing. Those who watch Amazon stock over the last several years would have noticed that Amazon is probably doing a lot of things right. And I don't just mean in the stock price, like the actual performance of the company, at least in some ways, justifies that stock price. This is not an investment show. I'm not obviously giving investment advice. But clearly, Jeff Bezos and Amazon are doing some things correctly. And that's where that other end of the barbell comes in. And the barbell, for those who don't know, relates to sort of, you look at a graph of some sort of strategy or some sort of outcome or portfolio allocation, where you've got extremes at the ends. That's where the weight is on your barbell for whatever approach you're pursuing. So that command and control really comes in, most of all, for those who are in the fulfillment centers or those who are at the quote-unquote lower levels of the organization. It's kind of like the Toyota production system. You don't blame the person, you blame the process. And so, processes are clearly spelled out and iterated upon so that they are nearly flawless, and a person, an actual human, doing the process cannot possibly screw up. So, besides just illustrating the contrast there between the Amazon and the military, although there are plenty of similarities as well. Plenty of military people have made their way to Amazon over the years. Besides just relating that story, the question is, how can we come up with a process that's kind of foolproof for ourselves to stop tinkering once we actually make a decision and then act like that startup that's trying to achieve productive ends? Okay, so here are the tips. And for a bunch of you, you're like, thanks for all the story time, Shree, but I'm pretty happy to get to the tips. Those folks are very much like a few folks who were in every section in Harvard Business School who were like, hey, yeah, like that 90-minute discussion was great, but all I really needed was the framework. Just give me the framework. A framework being like inevitably some sort of 2x2 matrix where you've got different quadrants and it's sort of, that's the big takeaway. It's some sort of tool you can use, a little piece of paper. It's a little something you can jot down on a whiteboard in front of clients and everyone has this aha moment and all of a sudden you've achieved clarity, clairvoyance maybe. And whereas I was saying, hey, everything in that 90-minute discussion was amazing. I mean, that framework was kind of okay, like maybe a little common sense, whatever. I may or may not remember this thing. Just interesting how people approach life and business and philosophies thereof. So without further ado, this is what I've at least come up with for myself. Hopefully it has some relevance to your own personal walkabout. So first of all, just be aware. Don't tinker too much. That's easy to say, harder to do, I realize, but just try and stop doing it. I think Jocko Willink talks from time to time about getting up early or solving some problems. And I'm not super familiar with Jocko, so take this with a grain of salt. But I believe from time to time, he sort of has this attitude of, well, just do it, right? Just if you want to get up early, just do it and stop feeling sorry for yourself and just get it done. And actually, there's a lot of wisdom there. I think the conventional way of thinking, the way that's most popular now, is just extremely erudite about everything, making everything overly academic, overly data-oriented, overly scientific, overly navel-gazing. But sometimes you just got to do it. You just got to see that clarity. And here it is. Stop tinkering. Next, I believe Ray Dalio talks about kind of dividing yourself into he who is the strategist, the optimizer, the planner, and he who is the worker. In the, I think, E-Myth Revisited book, the E-Myth Revisited, talking about starting businesses, there's the concept of working on the business versus in the business. So that can be a good metaphor for how you approach what you do in your own life, in your own work. You can work on it and you can work in it. And if you are a solopreneur or if you're trying to just solve some sort of problem in your life, you're the guy or gal who has to strategize and work. You need to find ways to divide your attention, your focus, your efforts between those two and maybe be explicit about it. Maybe in your morning routine each day or your strategy Sunday or whatever you do, you have time allotted to be that strategist. But then if you're not in that window, then you are the person working in the company of you. Next, have some criteria for knowing when a plan is done, when a plan is good enough. Think about if you, the worker, are presenting the plan to you, the strategist, and getting a sign-off and then going back and doing the work. If you had some sort of Michael Keaton Multiplicity action going on, by the way, great movie. I also saw some sort of Disney movie with my kids the other day where the character who plays some sort of teacher of these second-born royals, as in royalty, who are not the firstborns, they get some sort of special powers. Anyway, it was a pretty endearing and entertaining movie. If you're looking for something else to watch with your kids, which we all are clearly during the pandemic. Anyway, the guy who was the teacher had some sort of multiplicative power with himself. So he created a bunch of himself. Anyway, if you had a bunch of you who were reporting to you, what would you have them present in terms of a plan? And would you let them go back on that plan until they proved that it succeeded or not? What kind of success criteria would you have? What would you prioritize in terms of learning and strategy and iteration? Is the plan simple? Is it clear? Is it measurable? Is there an 80-20 here? Do you have conviction about the plan's effectiveness? These are obviously things you would think about as an executive in your company. Do you think about the same things as the worker in your life? Meanwhile, as is the case for all of us, you need to get at any mental states that are holding you back. A lot of times in our personal lives, our phobias, our problematic habits, our troublesome scripts are more a problem than when we're playing the role of that executive in the workplace. So get those mental states that are holding you back. Probably goes without saying, but this can't be a comprehensive list of tips and tricks and frameworks if I don't at least say that. Meanwhile, the best predictor of success in entrepreneurship, according to several sources, including that guy with the 48 Days to Work You Love podcast, which you should check out. If you're stuck, you should check it out. Anyway, the best predictor of success in entrepreneurship is time to action. Derek Sivers, founder of CD Baby and a guy who's been on several podcasts, he also seems like he could quite possibly be the nicest neighbor or best friend you ever had. He talks in his book, Anything You Want, which is great on Audible. He talks about how the best business plans are those that just take a few hours to decide on whether it's the right thing to do or not. That's that Richard Branson sort of character, right? It really resonates with those who were watching that Richard Branson with his lion mane of hair going about and screwing it, let's do it. So why not do that yourself? And Richard Branson is by no means alone. Think about Elon Musk. He's an awfully smart guy. I don't know if he's really academic. I haven't watched every one of his interviews. But if you think about it, if I were to ask you to start a space company, I mean, just end there, space company. I'm not even telling you what you need to do in space. I'm just telling you, you need to start a company that does stuff in space. Right? Or even if I told you, okay, let's set the bar way low, and I tell you, you need to start a car company. How long would you take to analyze whether that's A, something you should do, and B, how you would go about doing that? Chances are, you would take literally forever. You would probably die before you started either one of those things. Elon Musk arguably started those things within a few years of him studying these subjects. I mean, probably on the outside, 10 to 20 years at the absolute maximum. And that's while he was already starting other companies and had his hands very full. So decrease that time to action. Meanwhile, I'm reminded of who I call the career capital guy, Cal Newport, and his book, which we referred to before. He talks a lot about craft. And the thing that resonates most of all for me in this figuring out what your craft is and really investing in that is the fact that you have to love the process in order to trust it. I went to this podcast conference called Podfest in Orlando, Florida, right as COVID was kind of breaking outside of China and was getting a little bit bad in Italy, and there were a few cases in the US, not much by then. I went there, great time, learned a lot about my craft. Hopefully that shows here on The Warrior Poet. But one thing that came through in some of those discussions is the fact that for anything, and in that case, podcasting, one needs to really love the process. It's very fashionable to encourage ourselves to always think about how to outsource the menial tasks in what we're doing, whatever that project or venture is. It's easy to look at those processes and to kind of abhor them and to constantly be looking for optimizations. For me, I've really tried to reframe that personal dialogue for whatever it is, whether it's the podcast or other projects I have, to really enjoy that process of making and to relish the time it takes to create something that is hopefully great, at least to some people who receive that product that I'm offering. And for me, at least, if I do that, then I'm invested in the process. And I will trust that process because I actually love it and I enjoy it. And again, whether it's the podcast or some other project, I will continue at it and keep at it. And that's where the trust comes from in my mind, more than any of these other things. And that, at the end of the day, is what is going to lead to success. I think passion gets dismissed actually all too readily by some like Cal Newport, who I mentioned earlier. Passion gets dismissed very easily. And yes, can you learn to love something? Sure. But there's lots of stuff that we as humans rightfully hate. It's not always the same for each human, but it's not the case that we are all going to love everything we do. In fact, I think it's quite the opposite. So that passion is super important. And as long as you have that, as long as you have that thing that you love, and as long as you have that mission, it's kind of overused, but whatever that why statement is, and I'll be honest, I'm still working on that why statement for myself, but I have a collection of what's that are important to me. And so whether you're at that why stage already or whether you're very early on, as long as you have that stuff that drives you and that stuff that is your passion, you will be fine. And then any plan, as we say in the teams, any plan violently executed is better than no plan at all for any decision, any action process. When in doubt, fire, aim, ready. And now's that time of the program where we get all the way wet. Just a couple footnotes for you here today. The question of how we actually can have a process that's fully baked brings up another question. How can we come up with decisions at all? There's the philosophical allegory of Buridan's ass, where a donkey is tied up and there's water and or food tied at equal distances from the donkey. And the idea of the allegory, I don't think it's really true, but the idea of it is that because everything is at equal distances, the donkey won't be able to decide which way to go and will actually just starve and die of thirst in one spot in the middle due to indecision. It can be pretty powerful as a metaphor, though. There must be something inside our brains, some sort of randomness factor, or maybe it's just that organic material has grown in such a way to tip the scales where we can eventually decide something. I wonder why some people are just more prone to or more able to, depending on whether you view it as a benefit or an affliction, why certain people can make decisions better than others and faster. I suppose that when you're in a very risky environment, obviously that's a liability. When you're an environment of plenty, like today, and where the risks of decisions in terms of business, especially if you're in software and testing a lot of user interface issues, the costs of any given intervention in that space is really, really low. And so business rewards those who can make decisions very quickly. I wonder what it is in the nature and nurture that produces someone who can make quick decisions. And then finally, I think I've got it. I should have called myself the Engineering Special Projects Nincompoop. At least that's, I think, what I would have called me if I had been my boss at that time. Take care. Warrior Poet is a property of Rainiac Productions. If you like The Warrior Poet, there's more great content on Instagram. Follow Shri, The Warrior Poet, on Instagram. That's S-R-I, The Warrior Poet. You can also get to know me on a personal level by following Shri, actually, on Instagram as well. The Warrior Poet is produced by Laddie, with special contributions by Spoonman and me, Shri.
No, 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 no. Kevin, me no do it. Spita.